And you're not seeing permission.
Okay, no. All right.
Today we are on verse 12. We've spent the past 3 weeks on verse 11, setting up a strong foundation in the basic practice of taking and sending, which we just did. Hopefully everybody has a daily practice that includes taking and sending, meditation and taking and sending, because as we keep being reminded, our practice won't go anywhere if we don't actually practice it. So verse 12 is to repay theft with generosity, also classified as how to use loss on the path. If you read the class notes on the overview of verses 12 through 19, then you have an idea of why it's called how to use loss on the path. We will talk about that a little bit. Meanwhile, we're going to recite our verses, which I didn't set up yet, so we'll go find the file. Do a screen share. Not do that yet then. Let me get the file up first. Hi, Chet. Okay, where it's not giving me my, let's see if this works then. Oh, I'm having trouble doing the screen share today. Here we go. I can't make that a, can everybody see that okay? I can't make it a, I don't know if you're getting a full screen or a half screen. I have a half screen, but I'm not, don't have access to make it a full screen. So we'll work with what we got. Let us chant all the verses together to remind ourselves of this, all of the steps of this path that we're following, starting with the preliminaries. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade. Kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's the preliminaries, which we continue to work on. And now the three levels of the path of motivation for practicing. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. We strive in all our efforts just for that. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning, cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now we enter upon the path of action bodhicitta. And this is the verse we've worked on for the last 3 weeks and that we practice daily to exchange my happiness for others' suffering, the very basis of bodhicitta. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now entering the path of bringing our practice to our daily experience, not losing the connection between situations that arise for us day to day, moment to moment in life. Not losing the thread of our bodhisattva practice, our resolution to take on all suffering and give away all happiness. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's where we are. So let's start with the contemplation before we look into the commentaries. And today we'll just look at the highlights of Dingo Chenzi's commentary and Ken McLeod's commentary and possibly an observation from Geshe Jampa Tengcho. Let's talk about the contemplation. If anybody has anything they want to share about it, this contemplation of looking back at some time in our lives when someone stole something from us, ranging from, you know, someone breaking in and totally cleaning out all our possessions, which is what the verse talks about. And that would certainly be sort of the maximum reactivity that we would have to loss and theft. To somebody taking your parking space or taking credit for something that you did or something that you wrote or something that you painted, some idea you had, presenting it as theirs. So many ways that we can feel someone has taken something from us. And so let's just contemplate that for a moment. like if you can bring to mind some situation where that happened, either recently or in the past. And see if we can touch in on how that made us feel and how maybe it still makes us feel. Maybe we still carry some of that trauma with us. And I'm gonna unmute everybody there, and we'll continue the contemplation in a moment. Okay, I'm hearing noise from somebody. Okay, does anybody have anything that they would like to share about that? Any experience you might have had with this, Patrick?
An example of this in application is a few years ago, we suffered a robbery here, and the thief took the $300 that was in the Sangha's offering bowl. And when he found out about it, Ron Bogdan had subsequently had a fire in his apartment, and his co-workers at the Folger Library raised $300 for him to buy new stuff for his apartment, and he gave it to the Sangha to replace what was stolen.
Wow.
So that's number 12, right?
Right. Yeah. That's Ron. Yeah, that's Ron. That's number 12. How did you feel like in the moment? I know Marilyn talked about a little bit last week. How does it feel to have somebody steal all your stuff or steal your $300 to be broken into, invaded?
I'm pondering. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
What I'm pondering is that the expected reaction from what I've read, from what we're reading, is that the expected reaction is anger, and that's what we're trying to tame. But it doesn't really talk to either sadness or fear, which of course we could also try and tame those and use them, turn them around and say, you know, that this person must have been so afraid. But it's interesting that they go with anger, and maybe that's just more typical reaction.
Yeah, I would think fear would be a big part of it. I was actually broken into once when I was in college. I lived in a house in a pretty seedy area near where I was going to college. Getting a lot of noise from somebody. I'm going to mute everybody just for a moment again. Okay. And it was the middle of the night. I was supposed to be away for that weekend, and I decided not to go. And so I was sleeping in my room, and in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m, somebody opened the door and turned on the light. And I was like, who's there? And they fled. And I got up and I followed them. They had left the front door open, and they had peed on the floor in the hallway. I mean, they were scared. And I think it turned out to be one of my housemates. But it was really scary, and I didn't want to be in the house. I called the police, and they came, and they looked, and they made sure there was nobody lurking anywhere. I was like 19 years old. And they made sure nobody was there, but I was still afraid to be in the house. And so I got on my bicycle. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I got on my bicycle and just rode around until like dawn, rode around Richmond. So yeah, fear, I think fear is like an immediate reaction. And I think, as you said, we're taming them all. And I don't know if, you know, is it anger? Maybe it's me making up that anger is I see you, Anne, I'm gonna unmute you. Maybe it's me making up that anger is the main focus here. I think it was in the commentaries too, but fear definitely, and sadness, yes, sadness, like loss. And I think we work with all of them. I'm gonna unmute Anne now.
Well, I guess I'm going to say just what you said. Over the years, I've never experienced anything really traumatic. But my reactions over the years, when I look back on them, were very, very self. I just realized how much of my ego was involved in it, you know, from being angry to feeling it's unfair to feeling violated to feeling hurt. Mm-hmm. All these silly things that are just really have nothing to do with what the person actually did to you, because the person doesn't even know you. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful pointing out instruction of our own self absorption.
Yeah. I'm thinking also of, I see you, Chet, I'll get you next. I'm thinking also of all the times back in the 80s, when cars, you know, car radios were like something to be stolen, like in New York City, maybe other cities too. Our car radio, like people would break into our car and like they break the window and they take the radio, and it just happened again and again and again. And in New York City, people would put they put a note in their window, no radio, like don't break the window, no radio. And I think there, it's like, you don't feel anybody's going to harm you. You know, it's not like somebody breaking into your place. So I think it's more anger there and sort of resignation. I don't know. There's definitely, I see what Anne's saying, that it's about us. It's like about our reaction. Then you do turn to a little bit to why do they do that? And probably because they need the money to buy drugs or something. They're not going to get much for the car radio. And then you think, what a hard way to make a living. It's like risky. It's like... all right, Chet, you had something to say.
Yeah, we were robbed a couple of years ago, and it sounds like McLeod's description. He came home, the door was open, they took the TV, they broke the safe, and I think I really felt all those feelings. You know, part of it was anger that, you know, some very personal things were taken that really meant a lot to me, couldn't mean anything to anybody else. The fear, it turns out they were in an empty house next door and were casing our house for a while. We found out from the police afterwards. And there was also, I don't know, a kind of a sadness about it. Well, a fear thing, because they kicked out, that they beat our dogs out of the house with plastic Santa Clauses. It was at Christmas time too. So
how do you know that fact?
Sorry?
How do you know that?
because they found the dogs, the dogs were running down the street, but the Santa Clauses were out in the yard.
Oh, okay.
So they left them. Sad thing was, one of the dogs was deaf. And if a neighbor hadn't seen him and picked him up, the dog would have been just completely lost. Who knows what would have happened. Yeah. And then we went through the thing afterwards, where we got a security system and we put up gates. And, you know, they do the double checking on the locks. The really weird thing was, they caught the gang later on. And I got invited to go to a big police warehouse where they had all their stuff that they had laid out on the tables. Tons of, like, but the weird thing was, it was like people's family's photos and suitcases and albums and jewelry. None of my stuff was there, which then only reinforced being disappointed. But to see all this stuff that belonged to all these people's lives just thrown in this big room across all these tables was just very, had this very empty quality to it.
Yeah, I'm connecting with the sadness now that Marilyn mentioned.
Yeah. And one of the things, though, by doing this, I've never done this before until I started, after we're doing the readings and practicing, was I started thinking about them. And like you just said, how anxious they must have been and afraid, and what they would have done with it. When you talked about the person peeing in the hallway, I mean, think about, I started thinking about, gee, I would always have to run around worried about being caught. And then if I'm caught, what's going to happen? And, you know, just stuff.
And sometimes you get home and what you got was people's photographs.
Yeah.
What about smaller, like, so I can see that, like, it's a bigger ball of wax when somebody actually invades your home. And when you lose, like, precious heirlooms and, things like that. What if it's just a parking space? Like, what's our reaction then? Because that's, it feels like somebody took something that was yours. You know, you were waiting for a long time for this car to back out of the parking space, and there's no other spaces, and then this other car zips in. Like, to me, that's an anger one. That's like, how dare you take my parking space? And, you know, that's just mean of somebody. Or sometimes they don't even know, like, what they're doing. But so does anybody else have anything to share before we go into the second part of the contemplation? Anybody else?
I don't know. I think living in Washington, D.C. kind of helped me with that. So.
Yeah. Did you lose a lot of things there?
I just, I had to drive like an hour and a half on the Beltway every morning to get to work.
Yeah.
And I learned like, I can't be angry every morning at 6:30, like, in traffic, you know what I mean? So I guess kind of like would just develop that, just letting people kind of just go first a lot and, yeah, you know, I'll get there when I get there. So.
Well, I think that's a really good point that you're bringing up, is that one thing that we realized from this, and this is something that Ken really went into, is we have no control over our lives and things that we think belong to us. They only belong to us while we got them. Somebody else thinks it's theirs because they need money. You know, there's, think of what, how wonderful a person must feel like. They need money so badly that they break into somebody's house and take all those risks. And it's like a treasure trove. They're not thinking this belongs to somebody else and that person's going to be so sad. They think, oh, I found this great treasure. At least I impute that to them. You know, I think if we're involved in our own ego, you know, reactivity, they're also involved in theirs. Like, they were looking for something and they found it. So could we rejoice in that for them? I mean, I've had that feeling before. Like, you find something that, I found a $20 bill once. I was going to a museum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the Submarine Museum. Anne and Chet. And I was with some friends who were visiting from New York, and we got out of the car and there was a $20 bill in the parking lot. And like right next to me, and there's nobody around. I pick up the $20 bill and I look around like, does this belong to somebody? And there's nobody. And it's like, wow, I found $20 that somebody's probably really sorry that they lost. We used it for museum admission. We all got in for free, I think. But it can work both ways. And so this is one of those times, I think, when putting ourselves into the other person's shoes could really help us a lot. The fear and also the joy, like, oh, I found what I needed, which, as Ken McLeod says, wasn't ours to begin with. It's ours while we possess it, and now it's theirs while they possess it. And maybe the police are going to take it away from them, and they're going to be sad. But so let's just go back into contemplation mode a little bit. And so let's put ourselves back in that initial feeling, whatever it is that we lost, from a parking space to $300 to our peace of mind. Somebody robbed us of our peace of mind and our security. And just feeling the sadness, the uncertainty, the anxiety, the unsafeness, the fear, the anger, like whatever it is that we feel. Let's just feel that. And then imagine that we're in that situation right now with that loss and those feelings. Can we shift that? Like, what's the mechanism by which we could shift that? What would do it for us? Is it like, is taking and sending come to mind? Because if it does, problem solved. We could just breathe in our own feelings, sadness, anger, etc. Let it dissolve in our heart center and breathe out to ourselves security, happiness that we weren't harmed, happiness that we're alive. Whatever happiness there is, happiness we still have our health if we have it. So many things to be grateful for. We have our mobility. We might not have that thing that somebody took. Our mother's diamond ring. I think that happened to Jeffrey in New Hampshire. His mother's engagement ring was stolen. Somebody broke into his house. And then from there, can we put ourselves in the other person's shoes, the perpetrator's shoes, and feel the fear and anxiety that they probably felt if it was like breaking in and stealing something? And the need, the neediness. You know, maybe they really need it for, like, maybe their mother is sick and they don't have money for drugs, you know, for medications. And it's like Jean Valjean, right, in the Les Misérables. He needed bread. He just needed bread to feed his family. Or even if it is drugs, even if they're feeding an addiction, like totally zombied out. How horrible that must be. And just breathe that in too. We don't know anything about who stole our stuff or our parking space. We could breathe in whatever suffering they have because we know they have it. And breathe out to them happiness. And does that shift our own emotions? It might not. As Ken says, this is not a feel-good practice. It's not going to make us feel better. We still have the loss. We may still have all of those emotions. And that's okay. We can acknowledge that. This is not about what we call spiritual bypassing, where we go from being filled with anger and fear and anxiety and like doing some taking and sending and suddenly, wham, it's all joy. Like we're just in that happiness. It's really not usually the way it works for us. It might momentarily, and that's lovely, but can we continue the practice even as the emotions don't feel like they're shifting? And does that help in some way? So these are all, we're going to move on, but these are all, like the main point, the main thing is to remember to do it. Like with all Dharma practice, especially as we take it into daily life, the trick is always to remember, like, what do we have that will help us remember, like, in that first moment, like, before we've spent 3 hours sobbing and cowering in our bed or, you know, whatever our reaction is, how can we remember on the spot? And I think the answer to that, and maybe somebody else has another thought on it, and please feel free to share if you do, is the daily practice. It just becomes a reflex. We do it on the cushion. We do it in the chair, 5 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day, an hour a day, whatever we can do, the most we can do without pushing and burning out. And that gives us a basis for applying it in small situations in our daily life that are somewhat controlled. You know, somebody's just rubbing us the wrong way, disrespecting us a little, or, you know, the technology doesn't work in that moment. That's a big one for me. Or somebody's making noise in the next apartment or out on the street and you're trying to concentrate. We apply it there. And then when the big thing happens, we're used to doing it. We're used to it being a reflex. Listening to this wonderful live stream from Pema Chodron on death. And she's talking about, I think I lost my train of thought. There's a loss. There's a loss for you. Oh, yeah, she's talking about, I can't remember, one of her teachers talked to her. This is Trungpa. She's talking about Trungpa giving the advice, like, we need to train ourselves in how we react immediately when something goes wrong. And what Pema Chodron says and what Trungpa says, usually our reaction is OF or OSH. That's how Pema Chodron put it. And she said she's very aware of that. We don't want that, like, if we die suddenly, if the bus is coming right at us, and sorry, Jeffrey in New Hampshire, it's always the bus. If the train is coming right at us, or the car, like, the thing is about, we see the piano falling. We don't want that to be, like, the last thought we ever have. So Pema Chodron says she's training herself, trying to train herself, because she says she, OF is what comes to her mind too in some situations, which I love about her because it makes everybody feel better. She says she's trying to train herself to respond to everything with Om Mani Padme Hum. Just whatever goes wrong, just say Om Mani Padme Hum. And that could be your last thought if what's happening is the piano is falling on your head. She said, Trungpa Rinpoche suggested maybe you could get used to saying wow, like just wow. And that made me think of Steve Jobs dying, and his last words were supposedly wow, wow, wow. Maybe it was like a substitute for something else. Look. But that would be a good one. And so she said what she does, because sometimes it's OF. She says she'll say it, and then she'll go, oh, money, pay me hung, or oh, wow. And so you can do it in retrospect, just like we do when we screw up in life and we don't apply the practice in the moment and we do harm to somebody. We say something or whatever. Then we go back later when we're looking back on our day and we relive it. We could reenact it. We could do reenactments and do the right thing. I always wanted to write a book called Journal of My Corrected Life. You know, like a memoir, but you do everything like the way you should have done it looking back. That's still something I think a lot. Like I would do this. And that's a useful thing, I think, a useful process to go through. So anybody have anything they want to say at this moment? Before we look at Dingo Chenzi's commentary, which we're going to do quite quickly. Because everybody read it, right? already. See, I'm on my, that's not it. I'm on my Kindle because I'm not at home. So I'm bringing it up. I didn't think to do it before class, as I sometimes do. All right, here we are.
I'm going to take action because you may not have seen Fanny. And I know she has her hand up.
Oh, sorry, Fanny. I did not see you. Thank you. I'm unmuting you, Fanny. Thank you, Marilyn. I appreciate that. Okay, Fanny.
Hi.
Hi. We can hear you. We're very, very overjoyed.
Yes, thank you, John, for helping with that. We're happy with that. So it's good to see everybody. So this morning, you talk about like what was Rod. You know, it's my birthday this morning, right, today.
And today's your birthday?
It is, my 61st birthday.
Okay.
Yeah. And I awoke to two workmen with these drills outside my bedroom with my shades open because I like to watch the moon. And they were for all intents and purposes, they were in my bedroom. There they were.
Oh my God.
And it was funny. It was scary. And then I just like raised my hand up. You know, I was a little aggravated, but I raised my hand up. It was really loud, which is why I'm in my sister's apartment because it's too noisy in my apartment now. They're fixing the terraces. So then I went up to them, and then I was concerned because they're on this ledge on the sixth floor with a lot of wind. So I said, you know, I'll send you guys the picture. But it was just very sudden, and I just tried to change what was like annoying, waking up, you know, I wanted to sleep in a little bit, to be careful, guys, and can I photograph you? And drills that they use almost look like semi-weapons. They look like weapons of mass destruction. So he actually is wearing a mask holding this drill, and I photographed him on there, and then they sang happy birthday, so it all worked out. But it was very ominous. It was like ominous. If you just see the photograph, it looks like somebody breaking and entering. And they were literally in my bedroom.
So you had a fabulous opportunity to work with your mind in that moment, and you did it.
What else are you going to do?
I think there are other options. I think there are definitely other options.
Well, I have
so
no
that's
weapons.
That's the triumph of the moon. What?
I have no weapons in my apartment except for Scout, and she just was not going to go after them.
Yeah, yeah. You could be just angry at them. You could not think about their precariousness on the ledge or the absurdity of the situation or the irony that it's your birthday. I mean, you could have a different mental state completely, and you could still be suffering from that. You could still be angry. So it's wonderful that you could think of them.
Mm-hmm. It all coincides at the same time. You know, while I'm experiencing joy and gratitude that I made it to 61, I'm also experiencing a lot of letting go and loss. So it's like this ability of us, our mind stream, to have all of it, and we're, you know, fortifying the gratitude as opposed to the that. So anyway, yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Yes, thank you for sharing that real life, you know, that real life situation where you could apply it. You could apply the others first. Like, just, okay, what's the other person's situation? I mean, it doesn't even have to be others first. It's like, we could be at the first stage, as was explained about verse 11 and Dingo Chenzi's commentary. The first stage is equalizing self and other. Okay, I'm feeling invaded. Oh, I wonder how they're feeling. Like, what are they up to? What are their thoughts? What's their intention? You know, are they on a ledge? So you did that, and that's a triumph, I think. Anybody have anything else before we look at the commentary? All right, we're going to take a very quick journey through Dingo Chenzi's commentary. Again, I'm going to read the verse in his words, or his translator's words, Padmakara Translation Committee's words. If someone driven by great desire seizes all my wealth or induces others to do so, to dedicate to him or her my body, possessions, and past, present, and future merit is the practice of a bodhisattva. So that's what we're working with. What he does in the first part of the commentary, to me, is very much the same thing that Gampopa does in his patience chapter. Why you should not be angry with anybody, no matter what harm they do to you. And that's a good thing to review or to read for the first time in the context of these, you know, these bodhisattva boot camp practices. Because Gampopa addresses the same thing in a more general sense and gives us a lot of tools. There's like 9 different thoughts that you could bring to mind that are helpful. And some of them are the same as these 3 basic ones that Dingo Chenzi brings up in this situation. So first, you can be grateful that they took something you were attached to, because now you're free of that attachment. Or you can be, if you're a Dharma practitioner, if you can look at it that way, you can free yourself. Yes, Valerie.
Is this how we should think of this very unfair tax plan of the Republicans?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we can't go into that deeply at this moment, but yeah, that is, we could feel theft. We could definitely feel theft if, you know, if, as some people describe it, it's giving money to rich people and taking away our healthcare dollars and so forth. Yeah, we can apply the same thing. In terms of applying that, you know, something's being taken away that we feel attached to, well, we need healthcare. So I think we have to be a little skillful in how we apply the actual instructions and sort of adapt them to our situation. What we can understand in this situation is that we don't have control over it. And as Ken says, we don't own anything. It can be taken away and then we don't own it anymore. It's just, that's just the way life is. So what we're doing with these practices, first thing we're doing with these practices is accepting. I have no control over this. It's already happened. This is the way it is. In terms of things that are before Congress, we do what we can do. We call our Congress people if we are so moved to get involved. We do what we can do to stop it on behalf of all beings. I see you, Deidre. I'm going to let Deidre jump in here.
Yeah, I think I was actually following the same train of thought as Valerie, and I'm also looking at Kempo Soltram's responding to theft and Dilgo Chenzi, and I think what they're both saying is there's no justification in anger for a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
So you can feel that this may be unfair and to some people and even to yourself, but there's no justification for anger or no benefit.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that, Deidre. That is the bottom line, and I addressed that a bit in my class notes online. That's the Buddhist teaching, is that anger is never beneficial. And Gampopa's Patience chapter in The Ornament of Precious Liberation makes that same point. Anger is, it never helps us to be angry, no matter how justified it may feel. You know, no matter how justified it may be by the facts, anger is not the right response. What we need to do is work with our own mind. We need to find ways to keep our own equanimity no matter what's happening. But that doesn't prevent us from doing whatever we can to prevent certain kinds of harm from happening. So we do what we can do, and what we can't do, like, what is that? There's this prayer like, Lord, grant me the serenity to, Marilyn and Patrick, do you guys know that one? I see you nodding.
Let me see if I can remember that, except, I think I better not go with it.
Yeah, yeah. Look it up.
Yeah.
It's called the Serenity Prayer, right? And it's, you know, recognize the things I can control and recognize things I can't control, basically. And so the things that you can't control, you don't waste your time and your mental well-being dwelling in anger about that. Chat, yes, you may have a professional point of view here.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage the things I can, and the wisdom. Very bodhisattva, the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's because it includes the wisdom part.
Yes, wonderful. So thank you, Chet. So again, there are resources outside Buddhism to help us with this. Valerie, I know that doesn't solve your question in any way, but.
No, it does. It does.
Yeah.
And in a way.
Sorry, I'm just muted you. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry, you're unmuted.
I feel sorry for these people because they have so much and they're not satisfied, so they're suffering, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, they're suffering as much as we are. And that's the other side of this coin of loss, is that loss can be not only in the past and present, it can be in the future. Like, you think you don't have enough. Where does that lead you? Like, in terms of the Buddhist cosmology, where do you end up if you're so needy that you, in this lifetime, you can never have take from other people?
With the hungry ghosts.
Yeah, they're headed for hungry ghost. Rich people are rich only in this lifetime. If you use it badly, it leads you to a bad place. So, you know, we can think of them as gods, the gods realm. They're sort of the gods realm within the human realm. And they just have everything, and they don't have to think about anybody else. Never occurs to them anybody could be suffering, or that they need to do anything for their future. And so the end comes, and they suffer more than anybody. So that's where our compassion could come from, I think, in this particular kind of situation, is think of the karma that they're creating for themselves. And we don't rejoice in that. It's sad for everybody. We just maintain equanimity. We can do taking and sending for that. We can do taking and sending for politicians that we feel are destroying our lives and the lives of other people. But we do get in there and do what we can do. We can call our congressperson. We can be politically active if that is something that we have the capacity to do. But in the end, we have to accept what we can't control. So to get back to Dingo Chenzi's three main points here. So first, that doesn't really fit this so much, but if it is something, you just lost a possession or a parking space that you were attached to, we can thank the robber. Actually, Geshe Jampa Tegchok says, we could thank them, we could be grateful to them for stealing our bad karma, because attachment leads us to actions, mental, body, speech, and mind that land that create future suffering for ourselves. So if we can now cut through that attachment because we don't have the thing anymore, then they have lightened our karmic load. Second point is karma. Oh, that is the second point, right? They've lightened our so that I did the first and second points in one there. They've cut through our attachment, and we've paid off some karma. That is the second point, a little different. So when something bad happens to us, another place our mind can go besides anger, fear, sadness is joy, that some karma was paid off. I tried to go there. I find that very effective, and I tell the story in the online notes about when Kagyu Zalman Kunchab was broken into back around 1980. And people were so upset to get home and find out that, like, all of their money had been stolen, which was $40. They had no money. there just was no money. Rinpoche showed me once his checkbook and it was like empty. I think he hoped I would give him a donation, but I didn't quite make that connection. I was just like, oh, that's terrible. My first beginning career as a Dharma student, I flunked. But anyway, so when they told Rinpoche, they really didn't want to tell Rinpoche because it was all their money. And he was so happy. He was just like, oh, good. And he explained to them that something bad happens and nobody gets hurt. It's actually, you paid off some karma. Like, it wasn't $1 million. It was $40. That's kind of manageable. And nobody got hurt. Like, they didn't break in and kill somebody. So you paid off some karma. So that's point number two. These are just things we can think when we suffer a loss. So make a list. Put it somewhere where you'll see it. Like, you know, like, put it in your file cabinet under, you know, somebody steals something. What do I do? And you open the file and you read it. I mean, I do stuff like that. Because in the moment, sometimes your mind is too scattered and you fall into reactivity. You need those reminders. So number one, less stuff to be attached to. Number two, paid off some karma. Number three, what he says is a great bodhisattva. This speaks to what Deirdre brought up. A great bodhisattva never has angry thoughts toward anyone who harms him. Instead, his main concern is for that person's welfare. That is our job as a bodhisattva. And so we need practice because that's not how we react in the moment. We're not trained yet. We're working on it. And we see from people's stories that sometimes we do rise to the occasion. And that comes from our training, from training in this. But we need practice. So that's like the Buddhist teaching that we're all familiar with, that when somebody harms you, you should put them on, you visualize them on top of your head as your teacher. Well, this is one reason. About patience, which is one of the six paramitas, we can't get enlightened without it. He says, you can't develop patience if people don't harm you. There's nothing to work with. Trungpa talked about this a lot. We need that raw material to work with in order to develop new habits. So somebody does something bad to you, steals something or any other bad thing, we could go there. Like, this is a perfect opportunity for me to practice the Dharma. You could start with taking and sending. You could just replace your anger with compassion. Think about the other person. You could go others first. That's in your file, right, of how to respond when people harm you. Like, paid off karma, less to be attached to. Practice opportunity. others first. That was what I was going to say. Others first. Just make a list and have them. Put it on your wall, like put it on your mirror, wherever you need it, and it will help. So those are the three main points that he makes. And he summarizes the whole thing. And this does not apply only to verse 12, but to all of them. Take all the suffering of the person harming you into your heart and send him or her your own happiness with great compassion. That's it right there. That's all we need to know. All of the other stuff is just to help us understand it. But that's the main point. Whatever anybody does to you, take in their suffering. Think others first. How are they feeling? Like the guys on the ledge outside Fanny's window. What's their situation right now? And it lightens everything up. So others first is the key to everything. And you do it with a feeling of warm compassion in your heart. And again, we're training in this. Don't be down on yourself if you feel like you're not doing it yet. But we just keep trying. That's the key. We just keep trying. And then this practice that he gives us, and again, I talk about this in the online notes. This is a real practice. He really wants us to do this. There's another thing we could put on an index card and put by our bed or stick it on the lampshade, a post-it note. In the morning, your first thought when you first get up should be the commitment to do whatever you can during the day to help others and bring all beings to ultimate happiness. So that's two ways to help people. And again, you could look in the Ornament of Precious Liberation in the second paramita of moral discipline or ethics, list of 11 ways we should be helping sentient beings. But here, he's just giving us two categories. We do whatever we can to help them in the moment. They need a cup of tea, we give them a cup of tea. They need a kind word or a smile, we give them a smile. Guy in the corner needs a dollar, we give him a dollar. But we also always, within the context of of helping them in whatever way we can to actually awaken themselves. We can't do that directly for people, except by our example, maybe. So that's a real practice. I'm trying to do that too. I did that this morning. I woke up and went, okay, what am I supposed to think of when I first wake up? And I put it into my own words, and it was really helpful. So you can make your own words about it. And that's the end of that. We have just a few minutes left. I'd like to look at Ken McLeod for a second, because I thought his commentary was, again, so helpful. And as Kathy has pointed out, it's really helpful to hear these things, read these things in Western terms. It's so much easier sometimes to connect. Oh, that's what it means. We're not having to translate. So he starts out, as I think Chet mentioned, he starts out with this scenario. And I don't think everybody has the Ken McLeod book, so I'm just going to read through that. We're actually putting ourselves, this is like a contemplation again, we're putting ourselves in the place of the person that this is happening to. He says, you arrive home and step out of your car or your public transportation if you live in New York City. Something does not feel right. Your front door is open. Cautiously you go in. I mean, Chet lived this. Cautiously you go in. The living room is a mess. Your computer and television are gone. You go to your bedroom. It's been ripped apart. Drawers pulled open and clothes everywhere. How would this feel? The safe where you keep your valuables is gone, and so is your jewelry. You have been robbed. You don't feel safe anymore. Isn't that the first impulse? Like, oh my God. Your own home feels like a strange and hostile environment. That's why I had to get on my bicycle at 2 a.m. You do not know who or what to trust, and you are angry. Angry at the thief who broke into your home. Angry at yourself for not taking more precautions. Angry at a world in which people steal. We may or may not feel anger, but it's certainly a possibility. You want the thief caught and punished. You want your stuff back. You want him to know what it feels like to be robbed. You want him to know what it feels like to be frightened and scared. So you change the locks and install a security system. You have an expert find the weak points in your home and fix them. I know somebody has just been going through this. You know you have made it much harder for another thief to break in, yet you cannot sleep at night. You are still angry, outraged, and resentful. You feel you have lost something else, a sense of security, and you do not know how to get it back. And, you know, mixed in with all this, as Marilyn brought up, is the sadness. We've acknowledged the anger and the fear, also the sadness, the feeling of genuine loss. So Ken says, culture and society seduce you into a misleading way of thinking that the cars, furniture, clothes, and money that you own are actually yours. The robbery shattered that illusion. It is a painful learning, no doubt, but the theft has opened your eyes, and you see now that what you own is not actually yours. That's a big leap, actually. Can we go there? Like, oh, it wasn't mine in the first place. Or like that person, Tony something, who wrote the book, How to Be Sick, the Buddhist who wrote the book, How to Be Sick. I've talked about this before. Like when she gets some new shiny thing, her thought about it is it's already broken. So that when it breaks or somebody steals it, she's already, it's like the man in the lion suit. She's already used to the idea that she's only got it for a limited time. Eventually it's going to be broken or she's going to lose it. So you see that what you own is not actually yours. Can we live in that realization? Can we stop thinking of things as being ours? That's attachment. How to Be Sick. Ah, yes. John has the book. It's a great book. I really got a lot out of it. I read it when I was extremely disabled. I really related to it. How to deal with loss of your health. That's another loss, and another loss that makes you not only sad, but angry. Angry, like, how come other people can walk and I can't walk? How come other people aren't dying and I'm dying? How come other people, you know, don't have this allergy and I have this terrible allergy? Like, peanut butter, why can't I be in a place with peanut butter? That's a loss too. But we see through all of these losses that we don't own anything. And so we could, like, this is like practice four, right? To let go of attachment to this lifetime and everything in it. We work on that, you know, as a basic practice throughout our whole life. So he continues, you have the use of your possessions, but they can be taken from you at any time. What do you do? So he says you can stay angry or you can go inside. I mean, that's why Buddhists, you know, Buddhists are called nangpas, right? In Tibetan, it means people who look inward, not outward. We're not looking at the situation and stewing over it for the rest of our life. Instead, we look at our emotional reaction. You have an emotional reaction, you immediately turn inward. That's our reflex as Buddhist practitioners. You turn inward. What am I feeling right now? And is it helpful? And can I work with that? How can I work with that as a person on the path of awakening? He says, begin with your pain and upset. You have been violated physically and emotionally. That is a fact. You cannot gloss over it. Open to the pain in your body and in your heart. And, you know, you probably couldn't look at the guys on the ledge and start to see their point of view if you hadn't already acknowledged your feeling that I'm being harmed in some way. I've been invaded. I don't feel right. This is not right. This is not fair. So you acknowledge that. You accept your own emotional reaction. You're not pushing it away. But then you open up your perspective. Open to the pain in your body and in your heart. Explore how much you can experience of it, how much you can open to it before you tip over the edge and are lost in anger or fear or some other feeling. It's not helpful to let those feelings take over completely. So we look at the feeling, we acknowledge the feeling, we accept the feeling, this is how I feel, but we don't let ourselves sink into the quicksand. You still have to have that part of your mind that's looking at it from a bigger perspective. Like, where can I go with this now to work with this or to help this feeling dissipate or to help this feeling turn in a direction that's constructive? So he says, go to the edge of what you can experience and not be consumed and rest right there. Find your limit, rest a little short of it, and rest in it for a while. So you're acknowledging now your own pain, and then he says, now turn your attention to the person who robbed you or took your parking space. Touch how needy, desperate, angry, or cold you would have to be in order to steal from someone else by force or by cunning. Then mentally give to the other person everything he or she needs to be free and at peace. Do this over and over again. Touching and taking in that person's need, anger, and hardness. Touching and sending your good fortune and your care and regard for others. And again, your feelings are going to keep coming back up. This is not like an instant solution. So you go in and you look at, how am I feeling in this situation? Maybe somebody didn't steal something. Maybe somebody's screaming at you or just being unfair to you in some way. You go in and you really acknowledge how you feel about it. You let yourself rest in that. And then you turn to them. And you do taking and sending. You can do taking and sending for yourself and then do taking and sending for them. And you've already dislodged yourself from ego clinging. That is like others first or team other. We're able to do that. But your feelings may keep coming back again and again. So you have to do it again and again. Like, okay, now I'm angry again. Okay, now taking and sending. Like, the other person is really suffering. I appreciate that. Oh, man, that really makes me so mad. I just feel like crap. So you rest in it again, and then you go back to the other person. And we have to keep oscillating like this. Just like if you've been traumatized, you can't, like, be completely closed up in the trauma or you'll never get over it. You have to, like, open up and go, the sky is blue and I'm breathing and I feel the wind. And then the thing comes back again. You're back in the trauma, and then you open it up again. It takes effort to do this. You have to keep doing it. It takes perseverance, the fourth paramita, to do this. So expect that. And then Ken goes on to say what I think is like the most brilliant thing he says in this chapter. This is not a feel-good practice. Don't try to make it one. Just do it. Just do it. Just rest in those feelings and keep trying. And you don't want to do it. You don't want to think about the other person because they have harmed you. They're just being so mean and horrible to you in this moment. But you just do it. you don't try to make yourself feel good. You just know that this is how you're going to cut through your habits that keep you confused in samsara and suffering in samsara. He also suggests, and I didn't put this in my class notes, one way that we can practice for this when it's not happening is to recognize when we're feeling happy, or recognize what we have. Like, you have stuff that you're attached to, rejoice in it and send it to everybody. Do taking and sending proactively, but you can do both the whole taking and sending, or you can just send when you're happy, when you're having a good experience, when you're appreciating that you're alive. I have life, some people are dying. I can walk, some people can't walk. I have food, some people are starving. Just send everybody who lacks, send them what you have, and then you're more prepared to lose it when you do lose it. And then he said, and we're going to stop right after this, he said, this doesn't necessarily ever feel good to you. We're always going to be struggling a bit with what happens to us and with our internal reactions to that. It's a long path. But he says, if you keep practicing it, over time, you begin to really appreciate the way in which all our experience is like a dream. I had this wonderful memento of my mother, and I didn't, but this is hypothetical, and somebody broke in and stole it, and I don't have it anymore. So it's gone, just like my last night's dream, just like yesterday's weather. It's all constantly in flux. Nothing that we have is permanent, nothing whatsoever. And so by working with it again and again, instead of being just sucked into our immediate emotional reaction, by working with it every time it happens, we start to see how it all works. And we start to see that it is like a dream and an illusion. Everything we think we have in this moment is really like yesterday's, like last night's dream that's faded already. And that makes us less attached to things and to situations. And that makes us less emotionally reactive. And that makes us less likely to do things to hurt other people. And that makes us less likely to suffer. And slowly, slowly, over continuing, as we continue to engage with this kind of practice day after day, we liberate ourselves from all of the things that imprison us. And we become free. And that's the Buddha's teaching. Which seems like a good place to leave it. So we can work with this over loss. We're gonna confront a lot of other situations in Bodhisattva boot camp where we will confront different kinds of harm, but we're gonna work with them all basically the same way. So this next week, I suggest that we all tune into large and small feelings of loss, like unfair situations, somebody taking something that we thought was ours, you know, materially or abstractly, and try to work with this practice in that context. But people will harm us in other ways. People in governments may harm us in other ways during this week, and so we can apply the same practice to all of them. Taking and sending others first, write it all on your list, all the cues that will help you know what practice to go to and know where to go to find it when you need it. That's my advice. And don't forget Dingo Chensei's practice that he gave us. First thing when we wake up every morning, how can I help others today? How can I help them wake up? How can I help them be happier and more comfortable in the moment? And we didn't talk about the four immeasurables. I meant to do that. Just quickly, like that prayer, may all beings have happiness in the cause of happiness. May they be free from suffering in the causes of suffering and so forth. I recommend having that handy and reciting it in Tibetan or English, like as part of your daily practice. And really feeling it. And I just wanted to say that, like the third one, which is called limitless joy, it's not clear from the words what the meaning of it is, and people often don't understand what it means. May they never lose touch with true happiness, which harbors no suffering. True happiness that's completely free of suffering, unlike our regular happiness that's really suffering in disguise. The way that I've always heard that explained, and there may be other ways to explain it, but I've heard this from Sita Rinpoche, I've heard this from many teachers, it means team other. It's others first. It means when somebody else is happy, then you're happy. If you can rejoice in the happiness of others, like when you lose something, you could rejoice in the happiness of the person who gained it. Let them have the parking space, feel joy, then you're never unhappy. So, and then the fourth one is equanimity. And what that means is not an indifference, but it means we apply love, compassion, and joy to all beings equally. So we may talk more about that next week if we have time. We're out of time and past time now. And does anybody have anything they would like to say before we do the prayers for dedication? All right, so we will dedicate the merit with these four verses. Another way that we can be generous with sentient beings, sharing any benefit that we personally may have derived from being together today and studying and contemplating together today and meditating. Let's open up our perspective and share it. Send it to all sentient beings. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. So let's bring our minds to rest just for a moment. Let go of all of our thinking and just rest in how it feels to be in this present moment. And let's carry forward that meditative state of mind, that open awareness into all of our activities. You're all unmuted. I'll still be in Texas next Thursday, and I will get my phone hotspot out at the beginning, and we should be okay. Was the sound okay for the rest of the class? Okay, yeah. That's
good.
Now we know the solution. Yes. Was that Mark? Was that you?
I said yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope everybody has a great day. Don't forget to do some meditation every day. And I will see you next week.
Thank you, Lama.
And thanks to everybody for everything that was shared today. I really appreciate it. So see you next week. I will exercise my superpower now and end the meeting.